see, last week we had wrapped up with John chapter 5, a lengthy section that's found only in John's Gospel. This morning, I hope everybody has a copy of the Harmony. If you don't, raise your hand. We've got one more here. I think there's one at the back of the building as well, so make sure you have one of those. Particularly today, we're going to be wending our way through a section that has a comparison of the synoptics, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And so it'll be particularly helpful that if you do have a copy of the Harmony here this morning. And as I say, we're going to be starting on page 60. And if you look at the screen, I wanted to begin with a slide here of Endor. In 2011, Farrell Jenkins and I walked around here for quite a while. This is the actual site, I'm very certain, of Endor from the Old Testament times, of course, and the raising of Samuel there. But I wanted to point out that at the time, the grain was already right at the verge of being harvested. I asked Farrell why it is that these two rows on the outside had been plowed around all the fields. We noticed that in several different places. And he wasn't sure himself, so not quite sure what's going on there. But that's the site of Endor where the witch was, and this mountain right here is mentioned 10 times in Scripture. That is Mount Tabor, is how the Hebrews pronounce it. Spelled T-A-B-O-R. We've got a street named that not far from here, too. Tabor, I think, is the way most of us pronounce it. But Tabor is how it ought to be. Now, I want you just to take notice of the city there as we move in to this next picture, because when Pharaoh took this shot, that is Mount Tabor, and you see how very prominent it is. In a little while, we're going to be talking about the location of the Sermon on the Mount. This particular mountain is one of four different locations that have been proposed for the Sermon on the Mount. It's a minority view, this particular one, that I just bring it up, you know, while we're here in the general area. But our purpose here is to start in on Matthew chapter 12, where we've got this event about walking through the fields, picking the grain, rubbing it through your hands. And you can imagine yourself now, if you're walking through those fields, it's all just at hand height. You can just be grabbing it as you walk on through. And so this particular region, very beautiful, likely the location not here, but somewhere in Galilee when this event is taking place. Now, Farrell himself, the year before that he snapped the previous photo, took a shot, I suspect those are maybe even his hands, of actually, you know, working with the grain. And before we even read the passage, how much work would be involved in walking through a field where you didn't even have to bend over to tear off the heads of the grain and then rub it between your fingers so that, you know, the outside of the grain would be rubbed off, and you can munch on it there, your snack. Does that look like a lot of work to you? I don't think so either. But let's go to page 60 and begin the reading in Matthew chapter 12 at verse 1. At that time, Jesus went on the Sabbath through the grain fields, and his disciples became hungry and began to pick the heads and to eat. It's only Luke, if you have the parallel columns there on the far right, who points out at the end of his first verse that they were rubbing them in their hands. So they're picking the heads, they're eating them, but they are, you know, going through this rubbing action to begin. Now back to Matthew 12:2. But when the Pharisees saw it, they said to him, "Behold, your disciples do what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath." So they're pretty determined to bore in on Jesus with this one. Yet again, they think they've got some kind of real serious case here. This is a violation of the Sabbath. It's unlawful. They're working. Verse 3. But he said to them, "Have you not read what David did when he became hungry, he and his companions?" Now, before we go any farther, brethren, there's at least the implication here, and I feel pretty strong we need to put the two together, that Jesus is making a point about their being hungry. This was not a frivolous thing. It was not just the snacking that, you know, I humorously mentioned a moment ago.
But they're journeying, maybe returning from Jerusalem. We're not sure about the exact time frame here. But they're up in Galilee. It's that time of year, as you just saw on the screen. But they got hungry. It was not just, you know, missed even a single meal, probably. They're likely in the circumstances something similar to what David had gone through. He and his companions, they're hungry. It's a real serious thing. Verse 4, how he entered the house of God, and they ate the consecrated bread, which was not lawful for him to eat, nor for those with him, but for the priests alone. Mark adds, Abiathar is the high priest at that time, and what they did would be a very, very serious transgression. This bread that we're talking about is bread that has been consecrated to God. That bread from that Old Testament time, which these men are eating, they had never any right to this bread. Now, 6 days out of the week, anybody could eat that grain and rub it between their hands, and Pharisees wouldn't even, you know, get upset about it. But eat consecrated bread, as David did, is just absolutely never. It was an egregious thing. But they did it. In verse 5, he adds, or have you not read in the law that on the Sabbath, the priests in the temple break the Sabbath and are innocent? Now, by the way, I've tried to illustrate this a little bit in some previous lessons in the course of this last year, showing you some artists' illustrations and whatnot. How hard did a priest have to work under, you know, that old system? That was brutally hard work. Those men not only were involved in wrestling with these animals, slaughtering these animals, you know, first to kill it, there would be some resistance there, and then you have, you know, the effort of butchering this animal, carrying the meat wherever they needed to go from the place of the butchering, which would be, you know, some number of steps, so probably, you know, 100 feet, something like that, you know, by the time you get to the temple, especially. And so then, what is a wave offering? Just what it sounds like. And we're not sure exactly, you know, what the motion was, but it appears that they would hold this up and they would wave it somehow before the Lord. What's a heave offering? It's a different action, but it's another lifting, you know, physically. And you're doing all of this in the presence of very high what? Heat from where they're going to actually then be burning this, or in some cases boiling these meats. It was just brutally hard work. So when a priest is offering a sacrifice on a Sabbath, he's working harder than anybody in Israel does 6 days a week. It's not something that, you know, you could count as enjoyable at all. But he adds it, verse 5, Jesus does, and we're in Matthew chapter 12 on page 60 in the Harmony. He adds in the end of verse 5, and are what? What's the last word in verse 5? They're innocent. So, yeah, they're working on the Sabbath, and nobody denies it. But they're also innocent. And then, with the previous one, when David ate, was that wrong? Did he commit a sin? Well, absolutely not. So as you come over to the top of page 61 now, which is Matthew 12, verse 7, but if you had known what this means, I desire compassion and not sacrifice, and thanks to the New American Standard, they're so good at this, you have both the all capital letters to show you it's a quotation from the Old Testament, as well as in parentheses, the location of that quotation. That's the Old Testament prophet Hosea, chapter 6, verse 6. If you'd known what Hosea said there, I desire compassion and not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the what? A second time, it's the last word in the verse. Now, if you would, skip for just a minute to verse 27 there at Mark chapter 2, right at the top of page 61. And he was saying to them, the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. Consequently, in verse 28 of Mark's account, the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath. Now, for not the first or the last time this morning, note how handy and helpful it is to have these parallel columns. Matthew, Mark, and Luke all record that Jesus said, the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. But what about that verse 27 in Mark's Gospel? John doesn't record this account at all. Matthew and Luke don't record that verse. He said to them, the Sabbath was made for man in his interest, on his behalf, to his benefit, and not man for the Sabbath. God did not create man so they could keep a Sabbath. God did not create man so that the Sabbath would be a burden to them. God was not afflicting man, you know, with the Sabbath. And so these pathetic Pharisees have misunderstood, twisted badly, abused both the Scriptures, you know, and the people that these Scriptures apply to. And so they've just made life miserable and hard. They've turned the Sabbath into an odious, you know, and a difficult thing, something that really was never intended to be. So what do we have? Well, what we have is Jesus and his apostles innocently hungry, needing nourishment on apparently a significant journey, which may be the very one, all the way from Jerusalem, you know, through Samaria, or perhaps they're on the other eastern side of the Jordan, up and back again, even farther, now up in Galilee, walking through the fields, and they are hungry. Does the law allow gleaning? And that's what they're doing. Does the law forbid eating on a Sabbath? No. Likely it's the only meal, you know, the first meal at least, that they've had this day. Are they guilty or innocent? Jesus says repeatedly, they are innocent. And what's the problem with the Pharisees? What is it they don't get from Hosea? First, before these kinds of laws comes what? The capital C. Compassion. If you'd known what this means, I desire compassion and not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the innocent. Now, I've had occasion to do this recently. I do it every single time. You never know who's in the audience. And maybe was not there the last time. I've heard this before. You know, my apologies. But this is a very common construction in their language as well as in ours, that you need to always be alert to recognize, and it's just constantly, you'll find it everywhere in your Bible, Old Testament and New. Does Hosea 6 teach that if you're compassionate, you never have to offer another animal sacrifice? Does it say that God wants compassion instead of sacrifice? Well, it says, and not, but the construction there is a form of speech that is designed to emphasize one thing over the other. It is not intended to eliminate the other. So sure it says, and not sacrifice. But, you know, in our common parlance, we do similar kinds of things in our own language. You know, don't ever seize on this. It'd be a Pharisaic abuse, again, to get the idea then that you could excuse yourself from the Old Testament sacrifice. It's there for emphasis, not for exclusion. Saber?
Well, couldn't their objection be for the walking and traveling on the Sabbath?
That's possible. Okay. But it's not that they're recording in the three Gospels. You know, it's the rubbing, it's the eating. That's the thing that we're told. Now, sure enough, they're walking through the fields, so they are. You know, but did the Pharisees, you've all heard this from me probably before too, because it is so comical, but did the law say you can't travel on a Sabbath? Yeah, it did. It did. But now how far can you walk on a Sabbath before it becomes traveling? Well, the law doesn't address any of that. So what it was trying to say was, stay home, use it as a day of rest. You can't cook anything on this day. You can't build a fire on this day. You're supposed to be home and resting. So don't be traveling. Traveling is strenuous, that's true. But the Pharisees, it was their way, decided they were going to define very specifically what all these laws meant in 2 degrees in a manner that the law never intended. So can y'all remember what the figure was they'd come up with on how far you could walk on a Sabbath day before if you'd break a sweat and it would be work? You remember? It's about 7/8 of a mile. 7/8 of a mile. So if it was less than a mile, nobody had, you know, any complaint about it. So I don't know. Did they just wake up in the morning, you know, they're hungry now, they've only walked a half a mile? I don't know, but the thing that seems to be emphasized, you know, is that action. But it's a great question. Now, by the way, they further define this journey as being from your home. You couldn't walk more than 7/8 of a mile from home. I'm sure you must have all heard this story, and if you maybe they haven't, so forth, a few. How did the Pharisees then concoct a way that they could travel as far as they wanted to on a Sabbath and never break the Sabbath? You remember, Carol?
Well, they take pieces of home, and every 7/8 of a mile, or maybe a little less, they would put a piece of home, so that was their home, so now they could go another 7/8.
That's exactly it. They took articles of clothing or anything that'd be light and easy to carry. You know, you can imagine a Pharisee needs to take, you know, a 20-mile trip on the Sabbath. So he gets him a bag of old socks. And every 3/4 of a mile, what does he do? Drops the sock on the ground. Now, where is he? He's home, because home is defined as where your possessions are. So that frees him to walk how far? 3/4 of a mile. And what does he do? Pull out another sock. Where is he? He's home. Now, they really had a problem, though, if you were going to get on a boat on the Sabbath. So what did the Pharisees come up with? You get on a boat, you don't own the boat, Gentile captain maybe. Is it going to go more than 7/8 of a mile? You know, certainly it is. You know, you're going to start dropping your clothing overboard? You know, no. So they had to just add a proviso, and they said, except by water. So it's 7/8 of a mile from home, defined as where your possessions are, except by water. So here comes the punchline. Raise your hand if you've already heard it. What did they have to do when air travel was invented? Now what? Can't throw the socks out the window of an airplane. You know, there's no water. What do you do? So they got little jars of water, and they put it beside them. And now they're traveling by
water.
Except by water. They were by water. And so now you can fly on Sabbath. Go ahead before you want to go. If they had known what this means, I desire compassion instead of foolishness, then you wouldn't be condemning the what? The innocent. They were absolutely innocent. But what Jesus has done right here again is just so humiliating to these men. Now, Jerry made a good point not long ago, you know, that we need to be careful about accusing Jesus of purposely, you know, just annoying them or, you know, attacking them necessarily. And I appreciated that comment. You know, but nonetheless, can you be told that you don't know what you're talking about and not feel insulted and be angry about it? Well, that's what happens when Jesus says that, have you not read in the law that on Sabbath, you know, the priest in the temple, had they read that? Of course they'd read that. In verse 3, have you not read what David did? Of course they have. If you'd known what Hosea was talking about, do they think they know what Hosea is talking about? Yeah, so there's at least three ways where, intentionally or no, how embarrassing is this when you've made your attack and now your whole argument just goes up in smoke three different ways? Two examples and one prophet. Carol?
Designed reminds me of instrumental music. Because for years, people knew that meant with no music, no instruments. And it changed over time because people got too far away from
it. Far away, good point. 600 years after Jesus
built his church, you don't have anybody using instruments of music.
And universally, every record we have, you know, they say they're just adamantly opposed to it because it's a holdover from the old law. And we're Christians now. We're not bringing stuff over from the old law.
But given enough time, as Carol's been pointing out, get far enough away, you know, there's just anything can go. So, that brings us, though, to verse 27 in Mark again, 2:27. As you know, a year ago, February, we had the debate with the Adventists and talked about Sabbath for two nights. And if ever there was a passage in Scripture that the Seventh-day Adventist loves, Mark 2:27 is it. You can't hardly say hello on the street, you know, without them quoting Mark 2:27, do you? So somehow for them, and it really is a mystery to me, they think that Jesus saying, the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath, proves that they had to keep the Sabbath in the garden. They had to keep the Sabbath when they were thrown out of the garden. Everybody had to keep the Sabbath, you know, after the garden, across the surface of the entire earth. But this is just entirely incumbent upon anybody because Jesus made it for man. They read into this passage, when it's surely not there, the idea that if God makes something for man, then it has to be made for every living, breathing human being, and it has to be Old Testament, New Testament, perpetual, doesn't matter, has to be forever. This passage has never said anything like that, and it just is a classic abuse, I think, just like what the Pharisees are doing. They're looking for a way to justify carrying the Old Testament laws into the New. They want the Sabbath. And so, that, you know, of course it was Ellen White, their prophet, who said that they had to. And so they're looking for ways, though, to justify it in Scripture. Brethren, the Old Testament also says that woman was made for man. Does that mean that any man who ever marries is a sinner? No. It's a statement of fact. It's not binding, you know, upon anybody. The point Jesus is trying to make here is not that everybody on earth has to keep the Sabbath. That's not why he's pointing this out. Why did he say God made the Sabbath for man and not the other way around? Because what were the Pharisees doing? They were turning it into this terrible burden and making a mockery out of it. Didn't understand the compassion at all. And so it's sad and tragic, and it's been on my mind for over years. I've been studying ever since. You know, it started off with three Adventist preachers locally, got down to two, lost him, so now I've got one. And it's still a really good ongoing study, met with him last Tuesday. You know, but frustrating, because if you've made up your mind that something is so, you can find it in the most improbable places. The last thing on Jesus' mind in Mark 2 is to try and bind the Sabbath on everybody on earth. That's not what he's talking about. It's not why he cites or makes the statement. Mark.
It's kind of like today, a lot of people, when they look at the Bible, they don't understand it. They think it's a mystery type thing for God. God gave us this Bible for man.
Okay.
Because God already knows what's in the Bible. He didn't have it written for himself. He had it written for man.
Sure.
But yet people today think it's a mystery and we can't understand it because it's something only God could understand.
So we need, you know, the Catholic Church or somebody else to interpret it for us. You know, it's there on the page for all to understand. Great point. Great point. You can find several others like that with this four, you know, idea. But consequently, in verse 28, in both Matthew and Luke as well, the Son of Man, which of course is Jesus, is Lord even of what? So whether it was even legal or not, it is for them to do what they're doing on this Sabbath by eating this grain. If Jesus, as the Son of Man / Son of God, he's both, wants to say, we're going to eat, we're going to walk a mile and a half without throwing any socks overboard, you know, we're going to do this. Who is he?
He's the Lord of the Sabbath. He makes the rules. He makes the laws. You know, he can change his mind. He can have an exception. He can do whatever he wants. And so there's really a fourth way that these guys have completely missed the point. Okay, so any comment or question on this apparently in Galilee event being charged with working on the Sabbath? All right, so let's go on then. Page 61 and 62, we'll continue to use Matthew's our primary text. So let's just start reading there, Matthew chapter 12, verse 9. And departing from there, he went into their synagogue. And behold, there was a man with a withered hand. And they questioned him, saying, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath, in order that they might accuse him? And he said to them, what man shall there be among you, who shall have one sheep, and if it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will he not take hold of it and lift it out? How much more value then is a man than a sheep? So then, it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath. Then he said to the man, stretch out your hand. He stretched it out, and it was restored to normal like the other. But the Pharisees went out and counseled together against him as to how they might destroy him. If you read into the next section there, verse 15. But Jesus, aware of this, withdrew from there. Many followed him. He healed them all, and great multitudes followed him from Galilee and Decapolis and Jerusalem, Judea, and from beyond the Jordan. That Jesus is being observed everywhere he goes. And when these attacks are made by these Pharisees time and time again, you know, they're being publicly exposed for their silliness and getting increasingly more difficult for them, you know, and they're just ready to kill him already, and the Scriptures told us several times, and we're early on in Jesus' ministry. Now, the man with the withered hand. Jesus heals a man with a withered hand. In verse 9, he departed and went into their synagogue, and you'll notice in Luke 6, it came about on another Sabbath. So it's not the same day as Matthew 12. Thanks to Luke, we find out it's, you know, it's a different day. And he entered the synagogue. Luke also tells us there, you'll note, that he was teaching, and the man's which hand was withered? It was his right hand. So thanks to Luke, we learn it's a different Sabbath. We learn that he was teaching in the synagogue that day. We also learn that the withered hand was a right hand. Those three things are not found in the other passages. Now, if you look up on the screen, and it's the reason I was saying earlier, having a harmony of your own will be very, very helpful. Again, if you don't have one, raise your hand. I've got one right here. Anybody need to have one? Okay, but I want to focus in on this page. So I took a photograph of the page to show you the markings that I'm using in my particular copy. Brethren, this book that you hold today in your hands should become very familiar to you. It should be a workbook whenever you're dealing with the gospel. Now, you've got a separate study Bible. It's not the chronological Bible. We have different purposes for that one on Wednesday night. It's not your regular study Bible. You need to have a copy. But when we get done in a year and a half, we pretty well put it back on the shelf, and that'll be that. The Harmony is not like that. The Harmony is also not your regular study Bible. That study Bible is going to have all 66 books and all your regular notes, and that's your go-to book. But this Harmony, every time you're studying the Gospels, break it out. Now, I'm going to zoom in here and show you what all these markings mean, because I'm hoping that all of you now will just get very interested in trying to identify this unique material by comparing the three in these parallel columns. So, when you see something that I've circled in pencil right there, why did I do that in whatever column it is? Because it's unique to that particular writer. So Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and then all these different things that you don't find in others. Then I used red arrows, drawing my lines and arrows and little circles on the verse number, to show the flow. In most cases, I guess, brethren, does any one gospel writer, when you have several that tell of the same event, does any one gospel writer tell you everything that happened in the course of that event? No. You get bits and pieces from the others. then when you get these bits and pieces also, you're able to start constructing the flow of everything that happened. So having the harmony, let's start here with this verse 10 in Matthew. Put all these pieces together and then see the order in which they took place. Behold, there was a man with a withered hand. We're in a synagogue, right? What hand is it? What was Jesus doing there? You got the pencil marks to help you with that. Then they questioned him, saying, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? The other two say they were watching him to see if he would heal. Scribes and Pharisees were watching him closely to see if he would heal. But they were not only just watching him. Thanks to Matthew's verse 10, what were they also doing? They were goading him into it. Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? They're asking him to give some feedback. They're engaging him. So they're not just standing by waiting for something to happen. They're also trying to provoke something to happen. Now we move from the 10th verse, follow my arrow, over to verse 3 in Mark's call. And he said to the man with the withered hand, rise and come forward. And he said to him, is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm, to save life or to kill? Why did he say that? I believe, brothers, because they asked him, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? But that discussion now is part of the flow. He said to the man, rise and come forward, makes the guy very prominent. Now everybody's watching. He says, is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good, save a life or kill? They kept what? Who's the only one that tells us they kept silent? Mark. Okay? Then from my verse 4, see how I drew the arrow back up to 11 in Matthew? And he said to them, what man shall there be among you who shall have one sheep, and if it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will he not get hold of it and lift it out? How much more value then is a man than a sheep? So then it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath. And then coming to verse 5, follow my arrow, and after looking around at them, with what, Mark's the only one that tells us? With anger and grief at their hardness of heart. Mark's the only one that tells us that. He said to the man, stretch out your hand. So I'm hoping is that you'll work with your text like this too. I'm not going to do the math, you know, every time. But now, every time I go back, this is the third time I've used this harmony in a class like this, but whenever I go to the Gospels now, I've got my flow established on how this thing lined out, and then I read it all the way through with all the parts following my indicators, and you get, you know, this full picture. Learn how to do that. Work with the material that way.
To the book itself now, though, and turning the page there, in Mark chapter 3, verse 6, the Pharisees went out and immediately began what? The top page 62 in the middle. Taking counsel with the, Mark's the only one that tells us about these guys, taking counsel with the Herodians against him as to how they might destroy him. What is a Herodian?
It has to do with King Herod.
It does. Since before the birth of Jesus, Herod, the first Herod, Herod the Great, the one that reigned the longest and the one that built so many wondrous structures, engineering projects that are still the marvel of the world, many of them in Israel, one of the world's greatest builders in all of history. This guy would have a number of sons, one of the most fascinating genealogies you can imagine, a tremendous amount of murder that happens generation after generation in this family. And they are the ruling family over this region at this time. Herodians are not the family members, though. What is a Herodian? It's a Jew who is in favor or plays the game with the Herodians. How did the Herodians come to power? Were they elected in November? Were they inaugurated in January? How did they get to be the ruling family for generation after generation? Roman overlords put them in power. So, if you're a Jew and you become a Herodian, you are one who favors the policies, or at least, you know, obsequiously kisses up to the Herodians. You're trying to gain advantage and favor with the Herodians. Would that be the most popular view in Israel? No, a great majority of the people hated these Herodians, and the Herodians didn't mistreat them, and they had a lot of problems about it. So the Pharisees now are cahooting, you know, with who? Herodians. Most of the time, what affinity would a Pharisee have for a Herodian? Just almost none. I mean, it's animosity. But these men have no conscience. They don't care about, you know, being consistent. And so now they are colluding with the Herodians. Would the Herodians have reason to take note of Jesus and have some concerns about him? Sure, they're the ruling family. What do they see? How many people are interested in listening to Jesus preach? Huge multitudes. What does that look like to the ruling class? Potentially a revolution could become a rebellion. So they've got this in common, that they hate Jesus. And you see then these religious leaders making their alliances with their hated rivals in the political world and in the Roman world, and that because they have the one thing in common, they want Jesus killed. Okay, so that then brings us to Mark chapter 3 on page 62. We're going to use that as our main text now. Right-hand column, Mark 3, verses 7 through 12. This, of course, will be in harmony with chapter 12 of Matthew, verses 17 through 21, in the left-hand column. But Jesus withdrew, Mark 3, 7, to the sea with his disciples, and a great multitude from Galilee followed, and also from Judea, Jerusalem, Idumea, beyond the Jordan, vicinity of Tyre and Sidon. These would be Jews primarily, but could also include Gentiles outside of Israel's boundaries proper, to the coast north of there, you know, well north of Galilee, Tyre and Sidon. Great multitude heard of all that he was doing and came to him. And he told his disciples that a boat should stand ready for him because of the multitude, in order that they might not crowd him. For he had healed many, with the result that all those who had afflictions pressed about him in order to touch him. And whenever the unclean spirits beheld him, they would fall down before him and cry out, saying, "You are the Son of what? God." Now, you've been making the notes. I've asked you to do it. How many times does Mark mention Jesus' power over demons? In 16 chapters, he mentions them 13 times. This is number 4. So you're right there at verse 11 in Mark 3, demons number 4 out of 13. And he earnestly warned them not to make him known. We've read about Jesus telling those demons not to do that previously. Now looking into the Matthew column, Matthew 12:16, he warned them not to make him known in order that what was spoken through Isaiah the prophet might be fulfilled, saying, "Behold, my servant whom I have chosen, my beloved in whom my soul is well pleased, I'll put my spirit upon him. He shall not proclaim justice to the Gentiles. He will not quarrel nor cry out, nor will anyone hear his voice in the streets. A battered reed he will not break off, a smoldering wick he will not put out, till he leads justice to victory, and in his name the Gentiles will hope."
You know that's an Old Testament quote by looking at the text. What's the clue? All caps. What's the passage? Isaiah 42 and the parenthesis there at the end, verses 1 through 4. Jesus is not like the protesters in Eugene when Donald Trump comes to town. Okay? He's not out in the street waving signs and shouting. He's a gentle retiring guy. How many times do you read about him going away to be away from the multitudes, and they're pursuing him? And he wants to be known. He's preaching to these people. He's working miracles with them of all kinds. That's why they're coming to him. But now he's gone down to the sea, gone down to the shore there. He is being mobbed, and he's fulfilling the prophecy of Isaiah the prophet. Now, in Mark 3, next page, verses 13 through 19, just continue the reading. He went up to the mountain and summoned those whom he himself wanted, and they came to him. He appointed 12 that they might be with him and that he might send them out to preach, to have authority to cast out demons. And he appointed the 12, Simon, to whom he gave the name Peter, James, and I'm not going to read it, but now they're all named, all 12. And in the right-hand column in Luke 6 at verse 12, you find out he spent the whole night in prayer before this. Mark doesn't tell us that. We're told by Luke it was when day came that he chose them. We also find in verse 13 that he named them as apostles. And then Andrew is the brother in verse 14. We find that out only from Luke. So you put the two together, you know, find this additional information. And as we're reading this here on page 63, if you're standing in Capernaum, which the Scripture has called Jesus what? Home camp. This is his base of operations. This is the very gate when you walk into the site where you can look at the third century synagogue. If you just look right up the hill, you see that structure is an old Catholic nunnery from 1938 when they built it. How far is it when you're at Capernaum to walk up that particular hill?
7/8 of a mile.
Yeah. There's a whole lot of socks at the top. Okay. It's not far at all. You're really, really close. So he went up on a mountain, he spent all night, and he prayed. Was this the mountain? He was down by the sea, then he went up on the mountain. I'm going to close in just a minute or two, Michael, a minute over. But here from the boat, when you take the Sea of Galilee tours, in the trees, it's hard to see, but right there is that same dome I was talking about. And right here is Capernaum. It's just a short walk up the hill right there. So Jesus was by the shore of the Sea of Galilee, and he's probably been close to his hometown. And he went up on a mountain. My question is, from sea level to the top of this mountain is only 446 feet. What kind of a mountain is that to you? We'd hardly justify that as a hill. That's a molehill, you know, in our country. All right. If you were standing on the grounds of that domed Catholic church building that I just showed you a moment ago now, and you look across to the west, this is a highly zoomed-in view. Looks really close right there, but you know, you'll see that from water level to the top of that mountain, which is called Mount Arbel, is 1,247 feet. But it's 5 miles from where that domed building is, and it's 6 miles from Capernaum. Is that the mountain he went up on? Well, if it is, then he had quite a hike, maybe, to do it. In the next photo, you see that X. Imagine you're standing over there now, and you're going to look that way. Here's the scene that you would view over what is called the Plain of Gennesaret. You see the hills coming down. You're looking across the Plain of Gennesaret. Here's Mount Arbel. And in the distance, that plateau is called the Horns of Hattin. So, our location for these events, choosing of the 12, and what will follow next week, the Sermon on the Mount. We have to choose, was it the mountain I just showed you? It's only 450 feet high. Is it that Mount Arbel? Is it the Horns of Hattin? Or would it be a significant distance away, but still in Galilee, Mount Tabor that I showed you earlier? What do we know for sure? That we don't know for sure. My last thought is only, though,
It makes more sense, I think, the more likely prospect is, while we don't think of that as much of a mountain, that is the site most people think. So there's your little dome building again, and the hills are just perfect to have thousands of people arrayed like they were in a natural amphitheater for the Sermon on the Mount. Do we know for sure it took place there? No, we don't. Thanks for your attention. There's the bell. Class dismissed.